2 Romeo India Whiskey. And along with the help of K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, his name is Mel, my name is Dick. Mel and Dick try to coordinate a thing called the Technical Med. It's really a kind of a school in which we teach wireless techniques. How does radio work? And you can matriculate into the school by just having an interest in ham radio and the things that are connected to it, quite often computers. It's an open enrollment in this particular school, and we have lots of professors, so to speak, that are or teachers that gather in the New York City area, in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut area. So each Sunday night, these guys gather and teach each other how all this stuff works and how to make it work better and how to understand it all. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this. WS2N, Paul, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and your name at this time. K2RIW.
M2EO, Rich and yes.
And WS2N, Paula. No questions at this time. Maybe later.
Yes. Yes, Vic. WTWK.
Okay, so far we've got Rich, Paul, and Eugene. Anyone else?
KC2SYL, the name is Bill, no.
Bill with no, anyone else?
KBH, Jerry, no.
Okay, Jerry with a no, and I think there was a double. Who else was in there with Jerry? Wesley recognized, anyone else?
NY2H, since we're taking those tonight.
Okay, we get NY2H. Anyone else?
C2VHA, not at this time.
Okay. Rich, looks like you're the first yes we've gotten, N2EO. What's going on in Whitestone? You got it, Rich.
Okay, good evening, Dick. K2RIW, Tech at Weimark, N2EO. Yeah, I wanted to bring you up to date on that, project for 6 meters, the Heathkit SB110. If you're near a computer, you may want to Google Heathkit SB110A, and you'll see what it looks like. There's a number of online museums for Heathkit, and you'll get a good idea what it is. Uses a pair of 6146s, puts out 100 watts. The Vista front end. Been working on it since, restoring it since late January, early February, and I'm pretty much done with it, Dick. I wanted to bring you up to date. We thought last week there might be some oscillation in the front end, that noise on 6 meters. Turns out Barry N2MB came over. Let me let it reset. And we heard the same noise on Barry's IC7000. So it's some oscillator in the area, maybe coming from the cable system. It kind of walks around the band. It's in a few spots. Some spots it's not too loud. Other spots it's very loud. But anyway, I installed a preamp on the radio. I cut into the receiver front end line between the antenna relay and the RF stage. I put an advanced receiver research preamp in there and had it on during the contest. I purposely didn't make any contacts. I was checking the receiver, doing work on the receiver, but I was hearing 9s, 8s, 0s, 5s. They were all S6. 20 over 9 on that loop antenna. By the way, the loop antenna was not properly tuned. Barry went up there and set it up on Friday. We got a flat match, just about 1-to-1. So that's the story, Dick. Let me reset. I have another project in the works. I'm I picked up something called the Heathkit SB500. It was a transverter that goes with the SB110 to transvert from 6 meters to 2 meters. Uses a pair of 6146s, push-pull, cross-neutralized, and a Navista front end, and I'm working on that. So, for not a lot of money, we're going to have a 6 and 2 meter station going, and I wonder if you can recommend, well, I know you don't like to recommend brands, but do you know of anybody still making transverters for 432? I'm eventually going to want to go into that SB110 and convert up from 6 meters to 432. K2RIW, TechNet Lima, again, 2EO.
The last we heard, Rich, last week, is that you were troubled by the fact that ordinarily when you listened on 6 meters in the old days, you would always hear clicks and pops. And you were afraid that the sensitivity might have been very low because you were not hearing those clicks and pops of, you know, switches being turned on and off in the neighborhood. A good sensitive receiver would show those. And I guess you're saying Barry into MB retuned that halo, which was off frequency. A halo is an extremely high Q antenna. If, by coincidence, the darn thing happened to be tuned to 153 megacycles when you're listening to 150.1, your gain could be down 10 dB easily because of its bandwidth. So I wonder if that's one of the reasons why you were not hearing clicks and pops. Now that you are hearing distant stations like a K9 from the Illinois area on 6 meters, it suggests you have at least reasonable sensitivity, although the way band openings occur with sporadic E on 6 meters, a guy in Illinois could be running 1 watt of power and it could be a potent signal in your neighborhood under certain band conditions. So what was the final resolution of that one, Rich? How in the world was it just the retuning? In other words, did Barry find out that you had high standing wave ratio on your favorite portion of 6 meters? Is that what gave him the enthusiasm to go and retune the halo? And I guess you're saying you're using a 6-meter horizontally polarized, omnidirectional halo, something like a Ringo Ranger. And if you haven't already started using it, I'll bet you that sometime in the future you start using a 6-meter Yagi, where you can get quite a bit more gain in any particular position. So what was the final resolution of all that, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, once I put the advanced receiver research preamp on it, the thing really started to come to life. The S meter on band noise is sitting about S3, sits at zero when you pull the antenna off, so I'm definitely getting band 4, and I own a service monitor, a WaveTech 3000B, with a calibrated output on the signal generator. I didn't actually run a signal-to-noise ratio check, but I ran the generator all the way down, and I was able to plainly hear 0.05 microvolt. So if I wanted to go any lower, I'd have to stick a 10 or 20 dB pad in the generator to go any lower. So it seems to be pretty sensitive. It's not picking up any out-of-band garbage or anything like that. And as far as antennas, I hope by the end of the summer to get up a Glenn Martin tower rotator and maybe a something like a 5-element K1FO beam and some beam for 2 meters and 432 as well. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, a 0.05 microvolt is a signal level of minus 133 dBm. That's 133 dB weaker than a 1 millivolt signal. Extremely good sensitivity as I see it. You're getting down to the numbers that ordinarily to go beyond that requires some kind of a computer processing. That's a very good sign. And I guess you're saying that's with the advanced receiver research preamplifier. Those GASFET preamplifiers, most of them have close to 20 decibels of gain. And you didn't say, but I'm guessing that with that kind of sensitivity, you do hear clicks and pops, particularly if the antenna, I think you said it runs S3 when connected to the antenna and S0 when not connected to the antenna. So it sounds like you're really picking up over-the-horizon band noise like you should be. My guess is the sensitivity is not quite as good on your Wavetech service monitor without the preamp. Out of curiosity, did you measure the sensitivity without the preamp? Rich, go ahead.
Yeah, Vic, without the preamp, I couldn't get much below 0.5 microvolt. With the preamp, I'm getting down to 0.05. It's not a gas set, by the way. It's a 1.5 dB noise figure preamp. I think it's 3N120 or a 3N121. It's a dual-gain MOSFET, about 15 dB of gain. They do make a gas set for 6, but I just didn't think, to go down a half a dB noise figure or 0.4 on 6 meters, you really can't use that. So I went for, also what I was worried about was isolation on that relay. I cut into the receiver's relay section and inserted the preamp in the receive section. Gas sets are more sensitive. I was concerned leakage might pop a gas set. It was a good deal. It's a model P50 Victor Delta. Probably the best deal in amateur radio. It's very well made. It was $49 on advanced receiver research.
When you went from 0.5 microvolt with the rig barefoot without a preamplifier to 0.05 microvolt with the preamplifier, those two numbers differ by exactly 20 decibels. Sounds like some good engineering going on here, if you know what I mean. So many of those preamplifiers made by Advanced Receiver Research have very close to 20 decibels of gain, and that's exactly what you confirmed. When you were saying last week that you were not hearing clicks and pops, was that with or without the preamplifier? Was the preamplifier something you've added? And did you have a chance to measure what difference you heard on the band before and after Barry retuned the antenna? Back to you, Rich. And how high do you think the visual was before he retuned the antenna? You've got it, Rich.
Okay, the SWR was running about 2-1. And I think coax got a little wussy with that type of a visual. It's now flat. It's like 1.1-1. And I've been listening to a beacon out of New Jersey in FN20. It's on 50.068. And before I could barely hear it, now it's plainly audible out of the noise. 2S units out of the noise. I'm hearing some ticks and pops, but I'm in a very quiet area, Dick. What I really get is those oscillations that are running across the band, and I thought that was in the front end of the receiver, but like I said, Barry's radio was picking the same thing up in the same spot, so it's obviously not an oscillation generated in the receiver. I am hearing some noise ticks, some noise pops with the preamp, not without the preamp. But other than that, those oscillations, I'm in a very quiet area.
Don't complain. Now, what made you not, during the June contest of this weekend, which is still in force, still taking place, what made you not decide to try a quick transmission and talk to somebody on 6 meters? Go ahead there, Rich. You don't have to worry about channel 2 interference anymore.
Oh, that's very true, and I'm wondering if 6-meter activity now will pick up, because I remember years ago with channel 2, I would hear it from the neighbors. Today, no more channel 2. It's wonderful. No, I was just very, very busy with the receiver thing. I probably should have made a couple of contacts, but I was busy fine-tuning the receiver, We had some problems with the getting the preamp set up. I was running it off a separate 12-volt power supply, and then I made a voltage divider, and I miscalculated the voltage divider off the 150-volt line. I was fit to be tied. I thought I blew the preamp when I put in too much voltage. It turned out I blew a diode in the preamp, which I changed. And then what I went and did was rectified the 12-volt filament and filtered it, and I'm using that to feed the preamp. We had to run to Radio Shack and pick up a few jacks. So I've been using the contest to, like, listen and fine-tune the radio, because I know it's putting out 100 watts, and I've worked Barry and a few other people locally, and they said it sounds real good.
Hey, you know, that channel 2 is yours. Not completely true.
HWW, question for Rich Dick.
Okay, Eric, and Howie in that order. Channel 2 television frequency, 54 to 60 megacycles, is being used now by a television broadcast organization that calls itself, can't even think of the name of it now, it's a religious organization, and they brand themselves as Channel 42-1, and why can't I think of the name of it? So is that what you're about to refer to, Eric, that they're, that particular frequency range is being used, but it's digital television, not analog, and the chances of somebody hearing Rich's audio through a digital demodulator are pretty slim. Over to you, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. The issue that I'm talking about is really not digital television, because with digital television, they'll never identify you. The issue we're talking about here is that a majority of, especially in populated areas, are on cable. Now, cable's supposed to be 100% shielded, but it's not. Especially on a lot of TV sets where the back of the set has a 75-ohm transformer to twin lead into the tuner. Also, other tuners are not well shielded. So in close proximity, and I've heard of a number of stories now, where people are on 6 meters and they're getting all sorts of heck from people all around them. So let's not completely ignore that. Also, some cable systems really don't take care of their systems. They have open shields. There's plenty of ways of getting leakage in there. And if you're doing sideband or AM, there's a possibility that the home viewer is going to decode that. So back to you, the K2RIW, K2J.
So what you're saying is we're not completely out of the woods. Got to be a little bit on the careful side. And so I guess it'd be recommended during the Super Bowl in January football game, you might not want to blast with 1,000 watts on 6 meters on that particular occasion. You might make some unhappiness with the neighbors. And for those who know whether or not a 432 megacycle converter of any brand name is still being manufactured and is available, after we go to Howie, we're going to go to you, and you're going to be telling Rich the answer to his other question, where can he get one of those these days. Howie, go ahead with your question, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It's not really a question. Rich, did I understand that you didn't blow the preamp? It was just a dial. I was trying to call you today to tell you that probably what it is, because those, just so you know, they have a regulator. They have a regulator inside most of those preamps. Those preamps can work from 10 to about 18 volts. Over to you, Rich.
Okay, Howie. It was really a strange failure. No, it was not a regulator. They have a little glass diode coming off VCC, the 12-volt line, in series. All it is a protection diode to reverse polarity. And that diode, you would think it would have shorted. It opened. I found it right away. I put an ohmmeter across it in the forward bias direction. It was reading about 5,000 ohms. I said, this is it. So I changed that diode, and the preamp came back to life. Dick, I got another question. Howie brought up the preamp. I'm rectifying the, like I said, I'm rectifying the filament right now, filtering it with a 2235 volt electrolytic. And right now, you know, because 12 volts times 1.414, it's running a little high. They say advanced receiver says 11 to 16 volts. I'm running about 17.4 volts. I'm going to put a three-terminal regulator on the, a 7812, I think, between the preamp and the, yeah, I wanted to let it recycle. I'm going to put a 7812 regulator to drop the voltage down between the output of the rectifier junction with the filter cap into the preamp. But Dick, when AOR says 11 to 16, where do you get your best noise figure versus gain? 16 volts, I would think the preamp will give a little more gain and be less likely to clip. But I'm wondering where it's better. It's better to run it around 12 or 13.8 or 15. What's your opinion on that, Dick?
Doesn't matter. There's a regulator inside.
There's no regulator, Howie.
Okay, maybe on that model. Oh, I'm sorry. On the more advanced one, service. Go ahead, Dick.
Hey, you must have some variable power supplies, Rich, where you could actually run an experiment of putting various voltages. And the fact that you put some higher voltage, blew that series reverse polarity protection diode, and it became a fusible link. You're very lucky on that one. Very lucky that, I think you're saying it's not a gas fed transistor, maybe it's a bipolar, and no regulator. Most of the AR squares have a regulator. By the way, if you took the 12.6 volt filament winding from the tubes that are inside of your Heathkit SB110A and simply rectified it with a perfect diode, square root of 2, which is the peak voltage compared to the RMS of 12.6, gives you 17.8. With diode drop, you're going to get something in the vicinity of 17 volts. One of the ways that you can drop the voltage, since you, assuming now that this particular N2EO produced power supply, which is rectifying 12.6 volts, assuming it's feeding nothing but the preamplifier, and the preamplifier has a known fixed amount of current drain, one very crafty, simple technique you could use is that into the diode rectifier that's rectifying the 12.6 and giving you roughly 17, if you place a series resistor so that it doesn't get all the way up to 17 volts, but it only goes up to 12 volts on the filter capacitor when it's under load, you pick up about three advantages. Very simple, reasonably high efficiency way of cutting back the voltage that you get, because the conduction angle of the diode will increase. Even with that particular capacitor you're using, you'll get a smaller amount of ripple. A voltage regulator is one approach. A simple diode, a simple resistor, and series...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
A simple resistor in series with your rectifier network, whether it be single-sided or bridge, doesn't matter. That will give you a lower voltage output, a larger conduction angle, and a hell of a lot less ripple. But in the case of FET transistors, rarely are you supposed to exceed 5 volts on the actual FET when it's used in low noise service. Bipolars can be almost anything. And without the data sheet for that particular transistor, you wouldn't know what amount of emitter base bias, what amount of emitter current, what amount of collector voltage gives the best performance for a noise figure, or the best performance for gain, or the best performance for third order intercept point. Three different parameters you can set, and which is the one that you really want. Without the data sheet, you won't know, but you've got lots of ways of going. So apparently you've looked inside, or you've got the schematic diagram, and you're double darn sure there is no voltage regulator in there. That is a bit strange. I'm with Howie on this one. I think very few of the AR squares were built that way, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
One positive, there's no regulator in there. Absolutely no regulated chip, no transistor. All there is the one FET, and that's it. It's a very simple device. The reason I was thinking of a three-terminal regulator thing was protection on the filament supply, because, you know, I had a temporarily clip lead. I put one of these little coaxial type tip jacks on the back of, you know, the ones like what MFJ uses, you know, or anybody else uses on these 12-volt Q power supplies. And that's going to the brain end. I momentarily shorted the output of that rectified voltage, and I heard the transformer drone for a second in the power supply. When it turned to me, using maybe a 78-volt regulator would be a good idea, because if that should happen to short, it's got protection, no dick.
Yeah, before you told us it wasn't a FET, now you're telling it is a FET for that particular AR squared. And for them to build a FET preamplifier without a tiny, tiny little three-terminal voltage regulator that looks like a transistor, you're sure it's not there. What's the model number of the AR squared 6-meter preamp? Go ahead.
What I said, it's not a gas FET. It's a dual-gate MOSFET. It's a model P is in Peter, 50 is in 50 megahertz, P50VD.
Gotta have a regulator.
Okay, you're rather, you did say that earlier and I should have recognized that. Okay. Are you able to get a hold of the data sheet of that particular transistor that's in there, Rich? Go ahead.
Yes, I have the sheet that came with it. I filed it away, and I don't remember where I put it, but I remember looking at it and looking at the inside. There was no regulator in there, Howie.
Well, if they're using a dual-gate MOSFET or a MOSFET, they wouldn't run it at 14 or 15 volts. They would have to regulate it around 7 or 8, right?
Yeah. If the preamplifier is made for a 12-volt positive voltage input, quite possibly there's a resistor divider network in there which is feeding the transistor a much smaller number. I'm having a little trouble believing it's getting the full 12 volts, although it's possible. But you've got lots of ways of going to lower the voltage that you supply to it, Rich. A simple series resistor, I wonder had you considered that. It's opposite of common sense, but you'd have a very nice soft start. You'd have beautiful spike rejection capability into the 2200 microfarad. And you'd have a much larger conduction angle, much lower ripple. And you'd be dissipating less power with that technique than you will with the three-terminal regulator. The three-terminal regulator is going to take 17 volts in and regulate it down to 12. You'll be generating less voltage on the capacitor to begin with a simple series resistor. And the resistor will only be conducting for brief periods of time on the positive and negative peaks on the 12.6 volts, if you're using bridge rectification. And if you're using a single diode rectifier, there'll be even a smaller conduction angle yet. I think you see the principle here. You're about to ask, how would you select that resistor? And the easiest way is to put the right kind of a potentiometer there with the preamp as a load, simply start increasing that resistor until you come down to 12 volts. K2 N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Anyway, Dick, I may do that. I may actually get my second wind and go down there and do it tonight. But I appreciate the information. And anyway, if you get a chance, look up the SB110. By the way, as a side note, the SB110A, before I restored it, got my famous dishwasher cleaning. and the SB500 transverter went in the dishwasher yesterday. So it has to dry out between now and till at least a week or two past the 4th of July before I turn it on. But, you know, it's a wonderful way to clean up a radio. I've done a Collins 75S3B receiver, KWM2A, the Heath kit, and a few other pieces, and haven't lost a piece of equipment yet. The whole key is you got to let it dry out for at least a month or more.
Your SB500 transverter transverts from what band to what band, Rich?
Okay, it depends. There were two options. You could build it to transfer from 10 to 2 or 6 to 2. This one is set up to 6 to 2 meters.
Okay, so that gets you on 2 meters, and now you want a converter for 432. So, within the sound of my voice, does anyone know of any currently available transverter that has 432 operation coming down to any particular radio frequency you know of? Give me your call letters right now.
KC2QIQ with a comment, but not for the transmitter, but actually for the regulator.
Okay, and was there another person there with the converter information?
E2J, if you don't mind building it, you can get it from Down East Microwave.
Okay.
Eric, is it a 1-watt transverter, 10-watt, and do they have an amplifier for it if it's 1-watt?
Were you asking me, Rich?
Yes, he was.
The basic transverter, if I remember correctly, is 500 milliwatts. They've got an amplifier that goes with it. Brings it up to, I think they got a 25-watt brick. At that point, you could use anybody's brick, but, you know, be creative.
Okay, well, that's very good information. Because I don't want to have to go and convert from 2, because then I have to run the SB110 into the 500 and then get up to 432. I want to convert from 6 meters to 432, and I will be converting from 6 meters to 2 meters. So thank you, Eric. I will check out Down East Microwave. I certainly don't mind building it.
Yeah, go to their website. They've got everything listed there.
Eric, isn't there also a German company, I can't think of their name right now, not SB Electronics, but another very famous guy who has 432 and higher transverters?
SSB Electronics.
So it's SSB?
SSB. I'm trying to think of the guy's name. I bought a lot of stuff from him a number of years ago when he started the company.
And there's also a second German guy who builds converters that go all the way up to 241 gigahertz.
Same company.
Okay, SSB Electronics. So he's got at least two choices. And I guess you're saying the transverter made in England is out of business, although I'll bet you they appear on eBay periodically. What was the name of that company in England that was making a very famous 432 transverter?
Microwave Modules.
Okay. I'll bet you some of those are around. And I think that's a reasonably respected nice little black box converter, which I think runs everything off 12 volts.
Yeah, well, maybe one will pop up on eBay. Otherwise, I would, I'd probably get a enjoyment out of building this one from SSB Electronics. And if you've got a 25-watt brick, like Eric said, that's a good amount of power, and then we can go on from there.
Yeah, I think he was talking about the brick of Down East Microwave. So you got at least two choices, Down East Microwave and SSB Electronics. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead with your comment, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm kind of jumping in with this comment a little bit on the late side, but this goes back to the regulators again. And recently I was doing an ATV project where I was powering three preamps with a 12-volt source, and I needed to be able to switch the 12 volts on and off basically to get, you know, the up to 30 dB gain and 10 dB steps with switches. Let me let it reset for a second. And what I was finding was that I started off using, for the 12-volt source, three terminal regulators, 7800 series regulators. And what I was finding is that the amount of voltage that I need dropped across the regulator to give me the kind of regulation I wanted started getting a little bit on the lossy side, and didn't seem to be too good. And then I found that the amount of decoupling with very, very close to ceramic decoupling capacitors, they would tend to oscillate, which was also a nuisance. So the solution I came up with was just using a regular NPN transistor, a 12-volt Zener diode, and a regular silicon diode and forward bias, basically just to make up for the base-emitter junction on the NPN transistor, and just use very, very simple filter capacitance from the emitter to ground, and it gave me very, very good surge protection, and I can have a pretty wide range of input voltage, and it seemed to be nice low noise, no oscillations or anything going into the preamptic. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
WB 2HWW to comment on three-terminal regulators.
Yeah, Glenn first. I presume you were using your power transistor as an emitter follower. You didn't say that.
Yes, it is. It was power transistor, TO220 case, and you know, NPN, and basically with the current gain of about 50, and it was more than plenty to do the job. And as you can really have a pretty wide range of input voltage, because I believe it was a 100-volt device, and here again, you can have swings, voltage spikes, everything on it, and it gives a very, very simple... And to add, one other thing I did was across from the base to ground, across the Zener diode and forward bias diode, I put a 0.1 microfarad capacitor with a pull-up resistor. So basically that gives me even more filtering with the gain of the transistor, which is another nice little feature, Dick.
When you were using the emitter follower with a filter capacitor on the emitter to ground, yeah, the good news is that... it's a good spike eliminator and whatever for what goes on downrange. But had most of the capacitance been on the base side of the middle follower, where the current drain on the capacitor is very small, you would have had much smaller ripple. You still want a couple of microfarads from emitter to ground, but if most of the filtering was on base to ground, wouldn't that give you less ripple for the same number of microfarads? You'd be using the transistor almost as a Miller integrator, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Glenn.
Yes, absolutely, Dick. I know I mentioned that there was capacitance from emitter to ground, but I guess what I was trying to also relay was that there is a capacitor, about 0.1 microfarads, from the base to ground. And the advantage there is that whatever capacitance you have from base to ground, you've got the current amplification of the NPN transistor that gets multiplied by that current. So if you've got a current gain of 30, and let's say if you had 1 microfarad from the base to ground, that's the equivalent of that current gain times whatever the base to ground capacitance is. So it adds quite a bit of filtering capability, and it also adds swap start when you first turn it on, because as the pull-up resistor starts charging up that capacitor, the output to that regulator comes up very, very slowly.
So once again, was the majority of your filter capacitor on base to ground or emitter to ground? Where was the big 100 microfarad, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I wasn't working with values anywhere near 100 microfarads. I believe I had a 0.1 on the emitter to ground, and on the base I was using about 1 microfarad, Dick.
Okay, now I agree with you. So the big capacitor was on base to ground, and that 1 microfarad, if you had a... an alpha gain of that transistor, a beta gain of 30, then it acted like 30 microfarads. And if it was a low gain, a drain just to operate a preamplifier, that probably gave you some beautiful filtering. You probably had less than a millivolt of ripple. What do you think?
Every ripple that I saw, Dick, was below what my instruments could measure. So, I mean, it really supplies a very, very low output ripple, very, very low noise on the output. And basically to switch... That voltage on and off was very, very simple because I just basically cut the line in series with the collector. So in other words, I wasn't touching the capacitance or anything. I was just cutting off the source voltage with basically a low voltage switch, you know, coming from the unregulated side, and then I could just turn it back on, and then of course I would get that nice soft rise time and very, very stable output voltage. which really, it's really just a line regulator. It's not a load regulator. See, the problem with the three-terminal regulators, there's an amplifier and gain inside, and if they're not decoupled properly and have the correct amount of voltage drop across them, they can give you trouble. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
One last comment on that, though, Glenn. There are a series of so-called LDOs, low dropout regulators, and I think some of them will behave all the way down to half a volt, three-quarters of a volt, something like that. Are you familiar with those?
Yeah, I think, if you're working in very small areas where, space is a premium and you can't fit it, I would say that that's usually a good choice. And there's nothing really wrong with using three-terminal regulators. I use them in a lot of areas. I just found in this particular case where I needed extremely low noise, and I really wasn't depending on load regulation. I just needed power for the preamp, which was relatively consistent current. Wasn't really changing load very often. So I think overall it was a better solution to go with the discrete method, if you know what I'm saying, Dick.
Yep, and you understand the design and all of its quirks, and it could be easier. Howie, you want to make some comments on regulators? Go right ahead.
I was going to say that QIQ just stole the funding, said everything I said. I've found the same thing over the years, like 10, 12 years ago when I played with three-terminal regulators, like 7812, 7810. I found that they can be noisy, they can create distortion on an audio thing, and I've also noticed that you got to be very careful with the bypass caps and the lead lengths. And I was pretty surprised. So, the national devices, everybody thinks a three-terminal regulator, hey, you don't have to know nothing. Just put voltage in, follow the test, the little circuit they show you on the data sheet, and put a 0.1 on the input and the output. That's not all cracked up to be. You could have a lot of issues, Dick.
On one quick break, Howie, what was the worst issue you've ever had with a three-terminal regulator, and were you using it in the recommended manner with the right bypass capacitors, the right physical layout, and a reasonable amount of load and a reasonable amount of source voltage? Over to you, Howie.
I was using it with audio amplifiers, and what happened was you get like a little high-frequency noise or distortion. And that's what I found out, and what I found out that what you had it do is, I found out that sometimes you had to put a resistor in series with the cap to ground. I've actually found out that at one point on the output of this regulator, instead of having a direct cap, I might have taken like a 10 or a 20 ohm resistor in series with, let's say, a 0.1 or a 0.22. And that got rid of the thing. That got rid of the noise problem. Go ahead, Dick.
And when you look at the application sheets for many of those three-terminal regulators, that's exactly what they recommend doing. They do give you warning that if it has to drive a significant number of microfarads to ground, or maybe it's nanofarads, but there's a certain limited capacitance that it can drive and still remain stable and have a stable so-called Bode plot, as they say. And if there is substantial capacitance to ground, you do have to put a series resistor. So the application notes on many of those op amps tell you exactly that. Sounds like you're having a good time there, Rich, restoring all of that equipment. And we'll be hearing more from you in the future weeks as you make all these beautiful older pieces of equipment work well. Eugene was the next person on our list. W2EWK, what would you like to discuss tonight, Eugene? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, W2EWK, you turn it back to you, Rick. Well, I got XM radio, one of the satellite radios for the house. Now, the antenna they give you is a small, little tiny antenna. And I have an extra antenna for my TV. Now, I was thinking, of putting the bigger onto the satellite antenna. I was wondering what you think about that. I dream about that it's going to work, but I don't know. Kind of the frequency and that stuff. I was wondering, is it going to work or isn't it going to work with the big antenna? I'm trying to get more dBs into the receiver. That's my point. Back to you, Richard.
Yeah, I think your audio is a little bit hot, Eugene, so you might want to speak a little bit softer into the mic. Occasionally it chops out through the repeater system. The XM radio is what I think you're trying to put a better antenna on. Not quite sure if you're trying to do it at the home QTH or from an automobile. Are you using an antenna that was manufactured for that service and for that frequency region? Yes, as you add a better antenna outside of the car or outside of the house, you'll get better reliability of reception of XM, which is what I think is what you're seeking to do. So where is your location and what would you like to use for an antenna for doing that, Eugene? And to W2EWK, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I guess this is a little bit better. I'm backed up from the microphone. I was using the microphone before. I'm doing the antenna at my home QTH. I have the XM antenna on the XM radio. It works okay. But I want to get more dB gain from the receiver. So I was thinking of putting the big antenna onto it, you know, from my TV, you know, the satellite antenna. I was thinking of that there, Dick. Back to you.
You're going to have to give me a couple more words on that. You said the big satellite antenna. That's very ambiguous. Is it a 18-inch diameter DirecTV type satellite antenna? That probably will not do it. Wrong frequency range and wrong aiming. Or is it one of those 10-foot diameter television receive-only terminals? You said the big satellite antenna. I'm a little bit confused by that. And you did say the television aerial. So if it's the television antenna that's on the roof of the house, you know, on the chimney, it's worth a try. Nothing bad's going to happen, no matter what you use as a receiving antenna, given an experiment. But if you choose an antenna that was manufactured for that frequency region, I think you're going to get the best possible performance. So when you said the big satellite antenna, what did you mean by that, Rich? I mean, Eugene, W2EWK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, that's W2WK. I talk about the dish antenna, the 18-inch antenna. You know, the small antenna for the TV. Now, the XM antenna is like 2 inches by 2 inches. I was thinking of taking the dish antenna and putting it onto the receiver. Do you have it now there, Dick? It's only experimental I'm trying to do. I was just curious to see what was going to happen. Back to you.
I don't understand. And you stated that wrong frequency. Dish is a dish. No matter what size is a dish, it's a dish. It's not the dish that resonates. Back to you.
Okay. I agree with all of the above, but there's still a problem. The DirecTV dish is tuned with its low noise block front end. In other words, it's got a feed horn with electronics in that feed horn, which favors the 11 gigahertz frequency region. The way you determine what frequency a dish is on is what frequency is the horn and its electronics tuned to. The dish itself, yes, it's a very broadband thing. So the frequency is wrong because I think XM radio is somewhere around the S-band or L-band frequency range, much, much lower than 11 gigahertz. So his DirecTV dish has electronics favoring 11 gigahertz and a feed horn favoring 11 gigahertz, which is far outside of the frequency range of XM, and is aimed at a particular satellite, which is not where the XM satellite is located. So the dish is aimed wrong, the electronics and the feed horn is aimed wrong. Let's see if Eric is available. Eric, I should know and I don't know. What's the approximate frequency range that XM is on? KE2EJ, if you're available. K2RIW in the TechNet.
What was the question, Dick?
What is the frequency that XM satellite radio is on? Go ahead.
1.6 gigs. 1.625.
1.625. It's easy to take any element and tune it. You have a spectrum analyzer. You can actually get to the point and see that signal. Back to you.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Yeah, Eric first, and then Glenn in that order. Eric, to your knowledge, are there commercially available, not too expensive, XM radio antennas for his home QTH, favoring 1.625? Is that a Radio Shack product, for instance? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, you can buy it at Radio Shack. You can buy it a lot of places. They're not too expensive. I think they're around $40, but they're also active. They take 12 volts.
Which is not much of a problem. And the line driver of 12 volts up the coax cable, if that's the way it's done, means that he becomes rather insensitive for the amount of coax cable that runs from that antenna to his receiver. Glenn, go ahead with your comment. KC2QIQ, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I was just going to make the comment that definitely the antennas that are, you know, outdoor antennas are definitely available and readily available for XM radio. But actually, I have a better solution. Something that I've done here at the house is that if you have an internet connection at the house, XM radio supplies the same service for like a tenth the price of the radio service, where if you get one of their radios, you can actually configure it to work on your network. Either your wireless, the ones I've seen are mainly wireless network. So if you already have a router in the house and you have the network connection available, you can save a ton of money. It's like, because it costs, I think, like $13 a month or so to run the service in your car. But to run the internet radio as a secondary radio inside the house, it's only like $2 or $3 a month. So big savings can be made just by using the network service and getting the same exact stations and everything on the home unit and not have to worry about or bother with antennas. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
They run a lower bandwidth.
Okay, when you say the network service, you mean an internet connection? And is there a different piece of electronics that you're renting when you use the internet-connected service for XM radio? Over to you, Glenn.
Actually, you buy the radio. You know, you actually own the radio, and what you would do is you'd call them up, you'd call up XM, and basically just give them the serial number on the radio, and they'll activate the service for you for about, you know, around $3 a month, which is, you know, considerably less than the over-air. And, yes, it has to be connected up to a home internet network connection where you're connected to the internet. And it finds the server, and it plays beautifully. As you said, it's I kind of enjoy Sirius Radio. It's the provider that I'm using. And, you know, for the $3 a month service to have it in the house and not have to worry about antennas and everything else, very, very dependable. And I've got it connected to a wireless router. So basically, I can move the radio basically to my backyard, inside the house, anywhere, and all on secure network. Works beautifully, Dick.
When you buy the radio that gives you RF service at 1.6 gigahertz for XM or Sirius, is there another way you can connect it to the internet? Is it the exact same radio, or are you buying a different piece of electronics for this internet connection versus the RF connection? Over to you, Glenn.
They're different radios. This is not going to receive anything over, you know, 1.3 gig. This is strictly an internet receiver. It's designed to receive the signal directly off your router through the, you know, your regular wireless internet protocol. So that's basically how that radio is set up. I haven't seen one yet where you actually can plug it into the network, but I believe that's available too. I'm not presently using it. I'm using the one on the wireless mainly because you can move it around. But when I say wireless, I'm talking about internet router wireless, not satellite. And as I said, the cost saving is tremendous, you know, compared to what you pay for your car radio or, you know, over satellite. Because then you're paying back to that $13 a month again.
Yeah, and if you're an audiophile, you get less quality.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that next, Eric. You said that when you use the internet connection, you're getting a smaller number of bits per second. So a Sirius audio file is going to hear slightly lower fidelity audio. Is that what you're saying, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, no, what I'm saying is they use a higher level of compression. The stream over the satellite is about 3.5 megs, I think. And they restrict that through the internet. I mean, if you are an XM radio subscriber, you also get the internet service, which you can get on any browser. But, they have a regular service and a premium service. Same thing with Sirius. Actually, when I bought Sirius, I bought the lifetime, so it doesn't cost me anything. Whatever.
KC2QIQ with a comment on that?
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Eric. I mean, Glenn, and that is roughly $13 for the RF service and roughly $3 for the internet connection. Since you're buying the exact same service, why do they charge you more for the RF connection if you own the electronics? Or are you just renting the electronics for them for the RF service? Is that the rationale for the $10 more expensive? Why the extra expense for the exact same service? KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, first things first. What Eric was saying before is that if you're going to get the internet service on your computer, which is for free, you're getting limited bandwidth. That's a fact. But if you get the radio that's addressable to the network, which is now a radio very, very much identical to like in the car, in other words, you're going to pay for the service, you get the full bandwidth again. What's happening is once you sign up for, in other words, each radio is addressable. Every radio that you pay for, you're getting the premium service with the premium number of channels that you subscribe to. So when you get that number and you hand it back to them, they log it in and it accesses and turns that radio on, so it can basically spool and store the data in the radio. So that's what you're paying the service for. Is each subscription is each serialized radio. So the internet service, they charge much less than they do for the for over air. Now, I've listened to the quality on the radio that I'm subscribed to, and it sounds nothing like the computer internet. I mean, the computer internet, yeah, you can tell that's really bandwidth limited. Now, if there's a bandwidth limitation between the radio that I'm subscribed to that works off my router, it sounds as good, if not better, than the one in the car. So, I mean, maybe it is bandwidth limited by a little bit of amount or something slightly different, but I haven't been able to notice the difference. I mean, it's a real top quality. When you listen to the computer, yeah, I can hear the difference. So, yeah, there's a difference there. And each radio is addressable to a serial number deck, and that's what you're, when you're signing up for, you have to sign up for each individual radio to get it turned on.
I have a response to that.
Go ahead, Eric.
All right, the service that Grant is talking about is relatively new in the stream of things. The bandwidth that we're talking about, first of all, psychoacoustical compression to start with. That is the stream method in which their codecs operate. Not the same as what is on the computer. You don't get their computer service unless you are a radio subscriber. And by the way, one of the guys that I work with was actually one of the originators of the whole system for XM and Sirius. He's one of the consultants. Let me let it drop. The internet radio service, not the computer service, what Glenn is talking about, the stream rates run lower. That doesn't necessarily mean that he can hear the difference, but the stream rates run lower. Compression is a little higher. It is psychoacoustical compression. It takes a real expert to hear the difference. The amount of bandwidth that's allocated when you have it in the car, don't forget that's a continuous stream, and it has all the services going at the same time, where the internet radio service that he's talking about interrogates the central office. They send back the appropriate stream, which allows them to send a reasonable bandwidth, but it's not the same stream rate as what you get off the radio. And by the way, the radio, depending upon the channel that you're listening to, they will change the data rate of the codec. If it's just speech and it's a low-tier channel, it's going to be very compressed. If it's a classical station, it's going to be pretty wide. K2IWK2J.
Okay, so now, if I buy a premium service from XM or Sirius, and I'm getting the internet service, and it's properly connected, and I listen to that audio, and I'm a relatively serious audiophile, and because I'm a rich guy, I've also got the